Now, we're living in times when it's hard to be a Christian. There's immense cultural pressures upon us. The air that we breathe as we go about our daily activities and duties is very anti-God. We have so much in life as a nation, as a culture. We are blessed with so much. But the sad tragedy is that today man is at the center of his activities. Government, sports, the media. Our culture is very, very man-orientated and man-centered. And if you're a Christian, and we've seen that on the news this week, if you're a Christian, you are marginalized. You are pushed to one side. If you desire to do God's will and live for God and for Christ, you are seen as an oddball. You are different. And more often than not, if you stand out and witness, before you know it, you are a target, all right? You are a target amongst friends, amongst relatives, and amongst colleagues. And we're not to think anything strange when that happens. Now, the children of Israel were living in a time when it was a spiritual battle. When we come to the book of Exodus, it was a battle. And it would appear that everything was against them. Pharaoh, Egypt, the powers that be were against God's people and what God intended to do. And although it would appear it was man that was against the people of Israel, it was ultimately a spiritual battle. Satan was against God. And as we will see as we go through the book of Exodus, although these people faced immense opposition, ultimately God wins. And that's what we're to remember in all our difficulties and struggles. We're to remember that God wins. Remember that expression, one plus God is the majority. So if you stand on your own and you're standing for truth, wherever it may be, university, college, at work, remember one plus God is the majority. Now, the first thing I'd like us to notice as we turn to chapter 1, verses 8 to 22 is a big change that happens in the land of Egypt. It's in verses 8 to 10. There is a big change because there's a new king or a new pharaoh. A new pharaoh. Basically, it's out with the old and in with the new. And the previous pharaohs respected the children of Israel. They just let them get on with life. They let them get on with reproducing. And they let them prosper. And they did that because they knew Joseph. They knew that Joseph was the man. There was the prime minister, well over 400 years ago, had saved the nation from disaster. He was their savior, right? He delivered them. And the legacy that he left was that Pharaoh and the Egyptians just let the Israelites get on with life, get on with what they should have been doing, and that was prospering. However, after around about 400 years, a new pharaoh comes to the throne who doesn't know Joseph. It's most likely that this pharaoh was a foreigner. He had come in and conquered Egypt, and he started a new dynasty. And many historians and commentators speculate who this pharaoh is, but nobody knows. We don't precisely know who this pharaoh is. And we don't need to know. Moses doesn't tell us, except that this pharaoh ultimately is a tyrant. And the changes are significant. And sometimes when change comes, if we have a different government, a different prime minister or a different ruler, change can be a good thing. It can bring life. It can bring benefits. It can bring peace, harmony and prosperity. But here in the book of Exodus, in chapter 1, it brings trouble and hardship. It brings a lot of suffering and a lot of difficulties. And as the drama unfolds, again, we will see that Satan is behind Pharaoh. Satan has got his megaphone saying to Pharaoh, or in encouraging Pharaoh in wickedness and evilness. And that's what we must remember today. When wickedness abounds, when it's abounding in a nation like ourselves, behind the scenes is Satan. It's him who's dictating and calling the shots. And what we must remember, though, is that although the whole world lies under the influence and the control of the evil one, panics. This is a man who panics. And he's very, very insecure because he sees the Israelites are becoming too numerous. There's too many of them. And remember, these were increasing because they followed the creation mandate of multiplying and subduing the earth. And he saw the Hebrews as a threat to the nation's stability. Pharaoh loved his new gained power. He loved being in control. And really, this new king, this new Pharaoh, was paranoid. He lived in fear. He feared that the Israelites would join the enemies of this Pharaoh of Egypt and join with them in forces and attack Pharaoh. What Pharaoh saw was that he would lose everything that he had. He would lose his lifestyle, his palaces. He would lose his control. He would lose his power. And he would lose his luxuries, he would lose his wealth. And he saw ultimately that the Hebrews were a threat to his security. And he also feared that the Israelites, if they left Egypt, if they were to go away from Egypt, would side not only with the enemy to attack, but they'd be able to provide all the necessary intelligence to make the attack a lot easier. And We read in verses 9 and 10 the supposed threat and what Pharaoh does with this supposed threat. And you'll notice, first of all, that Pharaoh, because he's insecure, because he's paranoid, makes a public declaration. He makes the problem public. And there was never, it's very interesting, is there was never a problem before. It's only now that he's come to the throne that there's actually a problem. And his insecurity becomes a national concern. And we see how he deals with the Hebrews. And he deals with them, and Moses tells us, he deals with them shrewdly. In other words, he has a crafty and deceitful plan to subdue them, to stop their multiplication. In other words, he's going to do it deceitfully, just like the serpent did in the Garden of Eden. And you'll find that in the next few chapters we'll see that Pharaoh doesn't change one little bit, because all the time he's full of deceit. He's crafty, he's shrewd. And these characteristics come through over and over again. Pharaoh, we will find, is stubborn, and he's a man who constantly digs his heels into the ground towards the will of God. He's forever ducking and diving. He's forever being dishonest and untruthful. And you'll find that there's not many graces in his life. Now, with the help of his advisors, Pharaoh comes up with a cunning plan. And because they're too numerous, he doesn't want to lose them. And he doesn't want them to leave Egypt. So first of all, we notice that there's a big radical change in the leadership and in the rule of Egypt. Now, the second thing I'd like us to notice is the thing that Pharaoh does to reduce the Hebrew numbers and threat. Now, you will notice that Moses shows us he does three things. He does three things in order to stop them being a problem or a potential problem. First of all, his plan, his shrewd, crafty plan, involves making the Hebrews do hard, rigorous labor. For some of you, you may have read about what happened in the Second World War with the Japanese. When the Japanese captured any Allied soldiers and put them into prisoners, made them prisoners of war, one of the things that the Japanese did was to inflict upon them rigorous hard labor. Now, why was that? It was so that the prisoners will feel so weak that they'd have no strength and that they wouldn't be able to fight. It was the same tactic that Pharaoh did, all right, under the auspices of gang leaders, slave masters. Moses tells us this is what they did to the Hebrews. They made them work hard. It was hard work, and it reduced the strength. It was a way of reducing the strength and the vigor so that they wouldn't raise up an army. And it's very interesting that from verses 11 right through to verse 14, Moses makes a point of emphasizing the difficulties. All right, he's bringing to our attention, it was hard being a Hebrew under the Egyptians, under a slave master. You'll notice he emphasizes that they were oppressed, that their lives were made bitter, it was harsh, and the Egyptians were ruthless. And Pharaoh did all these things so that the Hebrews didn't become a threat to Egypt. Now, do you notice, however, there's a bit of irony in this passage, in this first chapter? Despite all the opposition, despite all the difficulties, the children of Israel still multiply. That's what we're told in verse 12. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were... No, sorry. Verse 12. But they were more oppressed, and the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So life was difficult, deliberately difficult, so they'd lose their vigor. But the more that they were oppressed, the more they multiplied. Very ironic, very interesting that Moses brings this out in the nation of Israel. Now, this is what we must understand is what we call the law of multiplication and growth in the kingdom of heaven. You know, our natural way of thinking is things will multiply, grow and get better if things are easier. All right. In the Christian life, we think, well, if the Christian life is easy or easier, a lot easier than it is today, then surely we will grow and multiply. But the law in the kingdom of heaven is when things are difficult, that's when we grow and when we multiply. Can you remember what happened in the early church? In the early church in Acts chapter 11, the church came under severe persecution and hardship under Saul, who later became the Apostle Paul. And what happened? What does Luke tell us happened? The church increased in numbers. It multiplied. You think of the nation of China. In China, there was a government, a regime that oppressed the church. It did everything possible to suppress Christianity. You know, there are more Christians, they say, in China than the rest of the world, some parts of the world, or certainly Europe. The more the Chinese authorities tried to stop Christianity, the more it spread. Difficulties mean growth. And this is the way we grow. We grow through hardships and difficulties. The hardships that we face, the difficulties that we go through. We wish they weren't there. But it's God's way of making us grow. So think of the disappointments. Think of the trials. Think of the temptations. Think of the things that we suffer, that we go through. How are we to view those difficulties and those problems and those trials? Well, through them. In God's kingdom, the law of multiplication is that through difficulties, we are people that grow. Jesus said to the disciples in John chapter 16 and verse 33, "In this world you will have trouble." Now, we can all spare ourselves a lot of confusion, a lot of heartache, a lot of disappointment if we understand just because there's difficulty, it doesn't mean God is against us. Just because we face these troubles doesn't mean God is not for us. Now, the cross is an example, is the example to show us that he does love us. So when we have an elderly relative who's causing us to shed tears, when we work for a boss who's selfish and bad-tempered, when it's chaotic, when we have a rebellious child, it doesn't mean that God doesn't love us. It's precisely because he loves us that these difficulties come our way. You know, I can remember a time in my own life when prayer had been just pushed to one side. Fellowship with God was just pushed to one side. And then in an instant, trouble came. And my heart was breaking. Why did the trouble come? It came so I would cry out to God. What does God want from us when we're going through the difficulties and the pains and the struggles? He wants us to cry out to Him. He wants us to grow. He wants us to have faith. He wants us to trust Him. And there are no exceptions to growth in the kingdom of heaven. Now, the second plan for crushing the vigor of the Israelites, and it was a very cruel plan, was that he had a conference with the Hebrew midwives. And it was under the leadership, these are the leaders of the, what would you call them, the top midwives, the matrons, is it? All right, basically the matrons of the Hebrews, all right? They ran the labor wards, or the Call the Midwife series. You know what I mean, don't you? They're the, I've forgotten the name of the lady who wrote that book. But basically, they were in charge, all right? And they were called Shifra and Pua. He has a conference with them, and he told them, all right, to kill every newborn baby. But not just all the babies, it was just the male children. Basically, it was the introduction of what we call selective genocide. If a baby boy is born, they were to be killed. And it was Pharaoh's way of eliminating the Hebrew males. And it was a long-term strategy of eliminating a fighting force. He didn't want an army to be raised up. And so he gave this instruction to the midwives. And the way that he did it, or what most commentators think is the way that he did it, was that the midwives would go along and suffocate the baby before the baby is given to the mother. It's cruel, it's harsh, and it's a way of suppressing the Israelites. And it was a way also of integrating the Israelite women, into Egyptian society, because later on in life, who would they marry? They'd have to be marrying Egyptians. So it's a way of them being introduced and integrated into Egyptian society. And Pharaoh, you will see now, is not just making them slaves and just not having a policy of slavery. He's also having a policy of death. He's cruel. He's harsh. Slavery and death. And isn't that a reflection of how Satan works? It's exactly the same. The prince of this world, the ruler of this world, Satan himself, that is his policy with mankind. It's slavery. When we sin, we are slaves to sin. And the consequences of sin, boys and girls, is... what's the wages of sin? The wages of sin is death. It leads to everlasting death. It leads to separation from God. And Jesus came to rescue us from that slavery and from that death. Now, we read in the account that these Hebrew midwives feared God, and they don't do what Pharaoh asked. So Pharaoh comes looking for answers. He notices, and he gets the word that there's still Hebrew boys alive. And he's astonished that the midwives haven't killed the baby boys. And we notice that the midwives come up with an excuse. Now, we must understand that these midwives were in a very precarious position. Very, very precarious. Because if they told the whole truth, their lives were in jeopardy, weren't they? And ultimately, lots of babies could have been killed. Innocent babies. And in verse 19, we read of what they say. They say, Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive. In other words, they go through all the pushing and the squealing and the grunting before the midwives come. Now, over the years, there's been an awful lot said about that passage and that verse and that comment and that reply by the midwives. A lot's been written, and many, many commentators have taken the midwives to task. Proverbs tells us, lying lips
or abomination are an abomination to the Lord. But we must remember, as we read the passage, God doesn't comment about the action of the midwives. He doesn't say anything. Moses just tells us what happens. And I've wrestled with this over the years. I've tried to square the circle. I've tried everything to put myself in their position. I've tried to see it from every angle. Were they right or were they wrong? Were they being deceitful? Were they being dishonest? And great difficulty. However, came across a commentator who said, really, what possibly was happening here in the account and the reply of the midwives was they were actually humouring, joking, making a mockery of Pharaoh. What do you mean? Well, what was the idea behind Pharaoh's action? What was he thinking all the time? What was his philosophy with regards to the Egyptians and the Hebrews? Well, he believed that the Egyptians were stronger, were better. They were better people. They were the ones who were far superior than the Hebrews. And what did the midwife say? Hebrew women really are that strong, are that capable, are that vigorous, that they give birth too quickly. You think that they're weak, but actually they're really strong. You're trying to suppress and wipe them out because they're weak, they're insignificant, but they're a strong people. Now, I came across a commentary written by Philip Ryken, and he illustrates this mocking answer, and he relates it to an incident back in Europe in the Second World War. When Nazi Germany occupied much of France, there was a village called Le Chambon. And in Le Chambon, there were some Protestant Christians, Bible-believing Christians, who rescued and hid 5,000 Jews. 5,000 Jews. And as you well imagine, these Christians faced an ethical dilemma. Imagine it. Have you got any Jews? If I say yes, not only will they kill me, but they'll kill 5,000 Jews. What would they do? What do you do? Well, the pastor of a congregation there was interrogated about the Jews that they thought were hiding in the village. And the pastor replied in his interrogation that he didn't know the names. Now, this was strictly true, because the Jews had just been issued with new false identity cards. So strictly speaking, you could say, yes, it was mocking the Nazis in the interrogation. On another occasion, a Nazi lieutenant asked where they were hiding the Jews. And the reply was, what would the Jews be doing here? Hey, you know, he's addressing a stranger. Hey, you know, they all have big, crooked noses. Now, if you don't know, in the time of Nazi Germany, the Nazis portrayed that all Jews had big, crooked noses. Well, they don't. Very, very small proportion do. He was mocking the evil lieutenant, wicked lieutenant, because they wanted to kill the Jews. They were humoring. It's possible that the Hebrew midwives were mocking Pharaoh. And wherever you fall, whether it's right or wrong, and knowing some of you, you will speak to me afterwards, that's fine, we'll debate it and we'll discuss it. Whether right or wrong, what we find in the passages, Pharaoh is satisfied with the answer, and ultimately, can you see the big picture? The descendants, the lineage of Jesus is saved. And the Hebrew women, and Moses tells us this deliberately, feared God. They feared God. Now, it's not right, please, this is where I stand, it's not right to tell lies. It is an abomination. It is a possibility that these Hebrew women were laughing, mocking Pharaoh.
Now, we also find that the Hebrew women midwives are also prosperous. God blesses the actions of these women. God turned this evil, wicked policy into prosperity. And then there's a third thing that Pharaoh does, and you'll notice that at the end of the passage of the chapter, verse 22. The next thing he does is has a snatch and catch, a grab policy. If you see a Hebrew baby, a male child, throw that baby into the Nile. Can you see how cruel and evil this man is? To have that as a policy in a nation. And basically the Hebrew children, baby boys, were going to be sacrificed in the Nile itself. Now, as we reflect on what's happening here in chapter 1, what we must remember when we look at the big picture, when we go through the Exodus, and I'm sure most of us know the end, God's plan and purposes will not be thwarted. No matter what Pharaoh does, he will not be able to stop Pharaoh. God. Can't stop him. God will have his plan and his way. Now, boys and girls, could you imagine an ant out there in the road? All right, the cars stop and the ant's there in the road. And then all of a sudden, an elephant starts walking up. Imagine the ant saying to the elephant, "Stop! I'm going to come first. I want to go on this road first. It's my road." Do you think the elephant will listen to the ant? Absolutely not. In this passage, in Exodus, Pharaoh is like an ant. He will not be able to stop God and his purposes. Isaiah tells us the nations are like a drop in a bucket. They are regarded as dust on the scales. He weighs the islands as though they were fine dust. We're also told that no one can hold back God's hand or say to him, "What have you done?" God is powerful. God is all powerful. And he will have his way. And that's what we're to remember in this day and age. When it's difficult to be a Christian, when it's difficult to stand for the truth, when it would seem all the policies that the government introduce are against truth and Christianity, we're to remember that Jesus Christ has promised he will build his church, and the gates of hell will never and won't be able to stop him. And can I encourage you, encourage us all, to be on the winning side. And if you're on Christ's side, you will win the battle. And that's the story of Exodus chapter 1.